We're in the Oregon Convention Center for the 32nd annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Society. Cognition in Flux is the theme. It's also the 10th anniversary. A symposium honoring 10 years of the David Rumelhart Prize in Cognitive Science. And I'm talking to Richard Schifrin, who is in fact the 2002 Rumelhart Prize winner. Waterman Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Indiana University and an expert in cognitive science, specifically memory as well. So, but let's deal with this cognition in flux notion. 10 years of a Rumelhart Prize. Next year will be the 25th anniversary of the PDP volumes of Rumelhart and McClelland. What's your sense of how the field has shifted, evolved? Is it indeed still in flux? Where's it going? What's your picture?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think cognition in flux is a word for what happens every year. And I would expect that never to end. All fields of science fractionate, divide, subdivide, narrow, coalesce, come together, and branch. And when you're talking about the human mind, which is about the most complex system and brain, the most complex system that anybody has tried to examine, one wouldn't expect this process to end anytime soon. So 100 years from now, we might still have a Cognitive Science Society meeting with the theme Cognition in Flux or some such thing, and it would be probably perfectly descriptive. It's hard to imagine that we're going to understand all the workings of mind and brain in any near future. It's a very complex matter.
But the notion of a shift, I mean, I suppose the current phrase du jour is a game-changing thing, but go back 25 years ago. The notion that rather than having innate structures and so on, that you're talking about networks producing emergent properties and so on. This is a very different kind of picture.
The Rumelhart and McClelland revolution, if you want to call that, was a major paradigm shift in the field and extremely important. It introduced a whole set of new ways of thinking about things, which persists and is being used extensively today. And it's terrifically valuable. I mean, it's not that any of our models or approaches are anything near reality. I mean, we're trying to model things, all our models, we're trying to produce models that will aid in understanding, and we don't really believe, if we are honest with ourselves, that any current models are anything other than crude approximations to some true underlying reality. But we want to make progress in the field. We want to understand more, and we use these models and these approaches to give us insights as to what's really going on, possibly to predict, although we don't do that as much as we should yet because it's such a complex system, and but really to sort of guide future research and progress and improve our understanding as we go forward. That certainly happened with the PDP approaches. It really helped guide new insights, new understanding, led to new research and new theories, and it's it was terrific. And it's not that there's any sense of right about any of these things. It's a very useful approach, one of many, a very useful approach to guide our thinking about how mind and brain work. And the idea of trying to get something like an actual neural system, not that a PDP network is actually truly neuronal, but something like a neuronal system that would act in this sort of composite and distributed fashion and learn and converge on, you know, concepts and so on. That was a great insight, great idea. And making it work was a terrific, you know, computationally, it's a terrific approach as well. So, yeah, it was wonderful for the field.
But the interesting philosophical and possibly, you'd hope, empirical questions there. I mean, how would you know if you had got it right?
Well, right, yeah, well, that's an interesting question, too. It's easier to know that we're not anywhere close than it is to know that we're there. I suppose we'll reach a point some year in the distant future where we can actually predict future behavior in advance rather than explain behavior after the fact. Most of what we do is explain after the fact. Occasionally we do a partially good job of predicting something in the future if we have a narrow enough situation, narrowly defined situation, that's been studied well enough that we've developed very good models, and then we can predict what's going to happen in that exact situation with a slight new variant, say, or something like that. So we're getting better at this, but even that's a big step forward when you have anything as complicated as mind and brain, but we're a long way from, you know, having a truly predictive model. When we get to that point, then we would, if we do, then we would say we've got something close to reality, because otherwise we couldn't predict.
So when I look at the papers in press in ticks right now, and there's paper by Jay, there's some rebuttals, shall we say, by Alison Gopney, Kenny Wellman, and so on, Andy Meltzoff, and then other comments by Gary Marcus and so on. It would be a mistake. I'm not putting these words.
You're talking about composite distributed versus symbolic or something like this.
Right. Yeah. So in a sense, to put too much emphasis on competing views in such a short time frame, relatively short time frame, is not a good idea in your view. There's a long view here, how it's evolving is not clear at this point.
A lot of science progresses by what might be called science by combat, and it works. People propose theories, and they're like their children, and they want to protect them at all costs, and then other people want to propose their own alternatives, and then we engage in combat, you know, scientific combat with each other, and defend our own theories to the death, and, you know, try to argue it's the best approach and the truth, and then other people, we all know, you know, in reality, we're nowhere near the truth, but we pretend. And it's one way of achieving progress in science, is one group defends their own children and another group attacks and substitutes some new approach. And in some rather stuttering fashion, science does make progress in this way. And, you know, it's sort of a tried and true way of proceeding, and in our field it's been used a lot. We've seen new threads come in. It's not, you know, PDP, and now we see a big push to do Bayesian modeling another recent trend that now is threatening to be the latest trend and so on, as an alternative, let's say, to parallel distributed approaches and so forth. You know, these things are all, they're all good. You know, they're all alternative approaches that are worth pursuing for their own reasons, and they each provide insights and gain. And I'm pretty agnostic about, you know, what works.
But this is an interesting point, because when I was making this point yesterday with Paul Smolensky, I was on my little soapbox, and I was saying that if the public understood a little bit more about how science is actually done, wouldn't it be better? And he was saying, I'm not so sure. It's not so clean and directed.
You do have to worry.
Producing certainty.
Yeah, you do have to notice that if the public fully appreciated the uncertainty and skepticism that we as scientists use all the time, whether they would misinterpret the whole enterprise to the point where they would say they don't know anything.
Yeah,
let's
yeah.
throw out science and substitute, you know, religion or whatever. You know, there's a danger of that. The public who doesn't know too much about science would want us to have clear answers. You know, and sometimes we provide answers in the sense that we produce results that they can see. We go to the moon, you know. They say, wow, that's pretty amazing. Or we produce an iPhone, or we, you know, the products of science, they see, and they see it works. That's great. But the research enterprise, which is full of uncertainty and noise and skepticism and false starts and new leads, I'm not sure that, you know, it'd be nice in a way if they all understood that and accepted it. But to educate the public about that enterprise has some dangers. And
it's not a great headline, is it?
I don't know if there would be something that, you know, it would be worth pushing too much. Maybe. I mean, if you had a sufficiently educated populace where they understood this from the beginning, starting in grade school and working their way up, that would be quite different. But I don't have the impression that we have an educated populace that's been trained properly during their lifetime, so that when they reach adulthood, say, and are functioning members of our population, that they would be appreciative of how science works.
Well, so let's take an example. I was just looking, there's a Wikipedia page there entitled Atkinson Shiffrin Theory of Memory, Memory Models, and so on. This goes back to 1968.
Yep.
Richard C. Atkinson, Dick Atkinson, who's full disclosure, one of the helpers and advisors of the Science Network when it began, also as Chancellor of UCSD, also President of the of University of California, and also director of the National Science Foundation, all right?
Yeah, so many roles.
Many roles. But also a memory researcher, also a cognitive scientist, and part of that revolution. You guys met at Stanford.
Met at Stanford. Dave Rummelhart was there at the time. Right. Dave and I overlapped 3 years. He was 1 year ahead of me. I started at Stanford working with Gordon Bauer. Gordon traded me to Dick Atkinson when he left to go on sabbatical in England my second year. It turned out I was working on short-term memory and related processes with Gordon my first year. Dick Atkinson was working on similar issues, so short-term memory, and modeling them with a group of people across campus. I was in one part of campus with Gordon, they were in another part of campus. So I was moved or traded to Dick because it was natural. And we hit it off right away and did a lot of constructive work.
Well, but so you're talking about ownership of ideas and so on. Here's one of your children. Still out there.
Yeah, it's still out there.
How's it doing?
It's still doing pretty well because there are, there's alternative views. The view we espoused at the time was making a fairly simple division of memory into relatively permanent long-term memory and an activated part of memory, which was the short-term memory system, and where you did the control of memory, all the processes, the working memory, the components that would make things work were in short-term memory and had limited capacity of various sorts. And that was the basic idea. And we had very many specific models that were included in that chapter for particular tasks, but that was the general idea. And it wasn't a unique idea. I mean, William James sort of proposed this, for example. And we just formalized it in many ways and made it much, and used it for modeling in a formal way, in a quantitative way. And because it was simple in one sense, and it was reasonable in another sense, and it captured insights people had had for many years, it was quite successful. And the fact that we provide the scientific backbone behind it, most people don't read, who use the model don't actually go back and read the original work. So this, but the fact that it's there is important. The fact that the science was there behind the hypothetical constructs and the thinking and so on is important, even if nobody now actually goes back and reads the modeling and the experiments we did. Because it was there and known at the time, and then it was sort of accepted as, the model's still pretty good. There are alternatives. There are people who say, well, we don't really have a different short-term or long-term memory, and so forth and so forth, and both from a neurological, a brain physiology perspective as well as from a behavioral perspective, I think that's not the general view. I think this general view, short-term and long-term memory is pretty common. That's a, still has remained as
what was your name again?
So I would say that it's, The model is still, it's called the modal model in some sense, and it probably remains something like still a reasonably accurate description at a very high level of what might be going on. Of course, there's been immense advances in the details about, you know, exactly what are the capacities of short-term memory, differentiating short-term memory into different components, and the visual and the auditory and the phonemic and the language components and all kinds of other things. So, you know, things have evolved, and the field is fractionated and studies little bits and pieces of this separately and so on.
Right. Just go back to Dave Rommelhart for a moment. I've been asking some of the people who knew him. What's your memory, your sense?
He was, I would say at the time, I would describe him, well, you know, my memory is a little bit dim. This has been a long time ago, so I'm not sure I have.
Well, actually, I shouldn't be. You would know better than anybody else that your memory is not.
Yeah, right.
So any longer accurate.
Somewhat reconstructive.
So what you would say today.
My memory today, as imprecise as it might be, is that Dave was a very smart, but relatively quiet. He wasn't an intrusive character. He didn't wasn't as vocal as some people in terms of just speaking all the time. But he was, you know, very insightful, very smart, and everything he did was right to the point. And you could see that he had a terrific amount on the ball at that time. He wasn't yet doing the work that he eventually became famous for. At the time he was at Stanford, but what he did do was really very good work in a somewhat different domain. And he had some very nice modeling. And I remember him as being one of the better, among a cohort of people who are now famous in the field, at the time he stood out as one of the best of the people there.
One of the tasks you were set, and the other winners were set, was to come up with a series of outstanding questions in cognitive science at this point, at the 10-year point. And yours was, what is context and its role in memory and learning?
My general view of this is that I'm surprised, that the earliest concepts that interested people about cognition were really about memory. Going back to the earliest writings of humanity, Aristotle, who knows? They were very interested in memory and how it worked, and, you know, because it sort of defines us. Memory is what we are. It's what defines us as people and our interactions with the world. And it's surprising in a way that we still know so little about memory in almost any aspect. We know a lot about, you know, how long we remember things and details and so on, but many fundamental questions are still unknown.
Including, what possible structures are there for retaining this stuff, and why can we have at least a reasonably good picture of how things were 25 years ago when each time we recall it, it's being changed slightly? I mean, where is it residing?
The neural basis for memory still remains a mysterious process. We know, you know, there's synaptic change and there's this very complex system that's somehow encoding memories, but the details are still largely mysterious. We know a lot about, you know, hippocampal involvement in episodic memories. Again, a large part of that is still mysterious and under debate. So on the brain side, there's still many, many, you know, issues that are not yet known. On the behavioral side, there's many issues that are not yet known. And the reason I ended up focusing on context, of all the mysteries of memory, the reason I mentioned context is, in a sense, episodic memories, as they're called, event memories, the things that we think of, you know, what I did yesterday and what did we talk about 2 days ago and things of this nature, they're defined by context. And context, unfortunately, or I guess unfortunately, are all the things we don't usually know about or control in our experiments. They're everything in the environment that's going on that we don't control and often don't know about, mm-hmm. which makes it very mysterious. So that the surround, so everything, right now I'm talking to you at the cognitive science meetings, and there's all kinds of things that are happening in the background that we don't actually think of, that are part of this event. the goals. What are we trying to accomplish here? What is your goal? What is my goal in talking to you? What are the goals of the meeting? What are the goals of putting this interview on the net? Very high level constructs. And then what am I doing in life? Why am I here? What did I do last week? But they're all part of this interview process. And then I'm reflecting now on my scientific history and, you know, how did that go? And what's, you know, what's going on? So there's enormous amounts of material, background material, that are part of the contextual surround of what's happening in this event right now as we're talking. And there's so many aspects of that that are there and important and critical to define what this current event is, that we then will store in memory, that is hard to get a handle on because it's so multidimensional and so diffuse and largely not studied because we don't quite know how to study it. But it defines our episodic memories, it defines our event memories. And later on when I try to recall this conversation, all these things that are in the surround are going to be a good part of what will help me access, remember, recognize things that happened in this event. The actual content of what I say is what we think about as the event, but it's all these other things that are really the contextual surround that identify the event in time, place, and with respect to our personal history.
Well, but that's almost that's almost a definition of how of something that you can't test experimentally,
almost.
Isn't it?
So we test little bits and pieces of it. So when we go in the lab, we're
getting... So individualized is what I'm getting.
We usually pick of the, you know, 200 dimensions of context or whatever are the main dimensions of the context. We pick some tiny little part of it and studied in the lab, like maybe the visual scenery, like, you know, this room that we're sitting in, this rather interesting atrium that... is at the convention center. That's part of the context. It's an important part. It'll help me remember this conversation, the fact that we're doing it in this rather pretty, actually, convention center setting with a nice view. You know, I may not have thought of that explicitly when we were doing the interview, but it'll be an important part of my memory.
Yeah.
But that's just a minor part. But that's one part we could study. So people study things like the visual setting in which an event happens, and we can vary that and see what effects it has and so on. Other aspects aren't yet very well studied, but they're critical for our memory for events. Although my recent research is now trying to move from events to knowledge, because I'm interested in how we let's say, build our knowledge out of the events we encounter, and then how our knowledge is used to encode the events as they happen. There's a co-evolution of the two processes that are critical for understanding memory as it actually operates. And most of my career, I studied episodic memory, event memory, without worrying about knowledge. And now we're trying to actually train new knowledge in the laboratory and then study the co-evolution of the two processes together, how they influence each other.
Some of these questions you have at the end here that you ask, does context provide the underpinning for embodied cognition? To what degree is old context reconstructed when retrieving? So when you're putting the memories of today's event back into the filing cabinet, loosely, it's changing each time it's taken out, put
I
back.
I think, yes, and I think that people don't realize how much of memory is inferential and reconstructive. This is an old idea, of course. Bartlett talked about it a lot, but a lot of people have. Maybe the lay public thinks of event memories as little atoms that we store in our brain and then we just pull them out and don't realize how much of memory is actually reconstructed inferentially on the basis of general knowledge, on the basis of bits and pieces of information that we actually can recall, and on the basis of context. And then we reconstruct a memory out of all this, and it seems like at some point, especially if it's a vivid memory, it seems like it's an atom, something that actually happened. But it happens, but in the present. It's a reconstruction that seems real in the present because we now reconstruct it and make a vivid memory, but it's not an actual representation of what happened in many cases.
Well, could that be because often in these descriptions of memory or in these tests that people take, they're often asked to recall flashbulb memories. So where were you on the day President Kennedy was shot? What was going on? And you think you have this veridical representation of...
There are some things... I mean, in some ways, it's remarkable how well we do remember. As somebody who claims all the time I have trouble with my memory for names and things like this, I have to admit that in many ways, it's amazing how well we do remember. Given that we reconstruct memories through inferential processes, given we store things very imprecisely and badly, it's quite amazing how much we do remember. And when we have people go on television and go on to Jeopardy, they do this and they do that, and they remember immense amounts of facts, say, and often remember lots of events. It's sort of remarkable we can do that given the processes we use to actually reconstruct memory, and I'm pretty impressed by it. And context plays a big role in that. Part also is knowing what we don't know. You know, it's sort of like that's not studied as much as what we do remember, but I'm impressed in many ways that a system that's as imprecise and as reconstructive and inferential as our memories are does as well as it does.
You have another question here about what are the neural and hippocampal underpinnings of context in storage and retrieval. I'm thinking also here about the hippocampus in general, about things like place cells, the Moses work, and so on and so forth, and the importance of hippocampus in constructing this the representations of who we are, where we are, and where we're going, and so on. And as I mentioned to you earlier, when you cut out of a school budget something like PE, which is movement, which is helping with exercising hippocampus, it's probably not a good move. I mean, there's all these things are tied together from the bench right into the schoolroom, it seems to me, as well.
I guess I would take the view that anything we can do to improve the whole body educational system, from exercise and sports and arts and music and so on, all the way through the nuts and bolts of education and science, would be important. And if considerations of hippocampal function or brain would help do that, then we should do it.
You're on board.
But anything that would do it would be good. Maybe I'm being a little bit, maybe I'm not emphasizing as much the importance of our field in terms of helping to justify things like a healthy mind, body, and brain as a unit, because there's a lot of research that shows this is important. But we need help in our educational system, and I would hope that what we know from psychology research, cognitive science research, would help us move in the direction of putting the resources needed behind improvements in our educational system.
Well, let's see how let's you use your memory at this point. And how did you do? You recall what the primary stimuli were for ending up in a science career? I mean, was it parents in science? Was it a book?
No,
or
I actually
came. Teacher?
I came out of a background where my parents were working class. My father was a garage mechanic early in his career, while I was growing up. My mother was, at that time, came out of a secretarial type original career, but by that time when I was born was a homemaker. So I suppose that they were nonetheless, regardless of the careers, were very interested in education, and thought that was the way to make progress in America. I guess that leaked through. When I finally got to college, I dabbled in many things, tried out many things. In fact, when I reached my senior year at Yale, I thought, my advisor told me I didn't have enough credits to graduate in any major. So it turned out that I could take all math courses my senior year and graduate, so I did. And I liked math, so that was okay. and I ended up as a math major. But how I got into psychology was mainly through an accident, because my roommates were in psychology doing honors psychology and doing research. So I had seven roommates. All of them were doing that. I wasn't.
Seven roommates?
We had the two suites of four each together, and we were sort of roommates. And I ended up talking with them about their various research projects. They wouldn't talk to each other, but they talked to me because I was the only one who was different. They were all doing these projects, so they all talked to me. So I was doing like seven research projects indirectly, you know, because I talked with them about all of their projects. And this went on for some years. And finally, I think this was my junior year, I said, you know, if I'm going to be doing this, I wasn't interested in psychology, but I was interested in research. So I said, if I'm going to be doing this anyways, I better do some on my own. So I walked over to the psychology building and started talking. I walked around until I talked to a few professors and said, you know, I'd like to get involved in research, and until I found somebody who would take me on. And the first people were Ralph Haber, and I did some perception research, and Naomi Weinstein. And then I moved on to Frank Logan, who was an animal researcher, and I didn't want to touch animals, but he had me do a human project related to his theories of animal research. And since everyone by that time knew I was interested in and liked math, they suggested that I might want to go into this new field, which I didn't know much about, called mathematical psychology. So they directed me to apply to several places that were known for that. And so I applied to math schools and law schools and psychology schools, but I guess I really knew I wanted to go into research and ended up at Stanford.
Hmm. So you didn't want to touch animals because?
I don't know, seems sort of messy. I'm not sure. I mean, there was no problem with research on animals. In fact, now maybe I wish I had done so, given the way the field has gone. But at the time, it seemed like it was a better idea for me to focus on humans and their behavior. It was easy. They were easier to work with. And I don't know. I just had a slight distaste for working with rats. I never did. So.
How did the work with Dick Atkinson come to pass?
Yeah, it was an interesting process because there were many people that Dick was working with. He had a large group. He had good funding. He had a large group of people working on short-term memory projects. But somehow or other, and I'm not sure quite how this happened, I seemed to be the one that was pushing the mathematical modeling along with Dick more than the other people he was working with. So I was able to derive various probabilistic predictions from the various models and then devise tests to make them work and so on. I had already done that a bit with Gordon before I ever got to Dick. And then we just kept going on in this vein. And I think it was my interest in combining the empirical research with tight mathematical modeling and derivations at the time that seemed to resonate between Dick and me. We were both similar in that regard, and more so than some of the other people he's working with, perhaps, so that we really ended up, you know, working very well together, mm-hmm. and being able to talk with each other on a level, even keel, even though I was a graduate student, because he was still a pretty young professor then. But nonetheless, we were able to operate together very effectively. For that reason.
So I've mentioned this to you before in outside of this setting, but and maybe it's a naive question, but let me try it again anyway, which is that, especially at a meeting like this with 1,000 people all in here talking about cognitive science, about the M word, about the mind, is it ridiculous for me to suggest or to wish that there would be one model of the mind that everybody subscribed to that you could then build policies on and sort of say, this is what the mind is like, and therefore all these kids in school have this thing called a mind. We should build our educational systems in accordance with this? Or is that just a completely naive view?
Well, I guess there's two different perspectives on that. One is sort of what might be called a practical or political perspective, which is even if science isn't ready to converge on one view of the mind, there's some practical reason why it might be a good idea to make a summary description as the best we know at the moment, so that we can take that out there and use it as a template for many good purposes. From a scientific perspective, as a basic researcher in science, I see all the problems, all the debates, all the things we don't know, and so on. So from that perspective, it would be a little bit, more than a little naive to propose that we actually know enough to actually do this. But there's some, you know, practical reasons for doing so. So I guess I'd be of mixed minds about this. As a scientist, I'd be dubious. But as a person wanting society to take into account a lot of what we know about cognitive science and take it seriously, and then do things like make educational policy on the basis of that, and make decisions about how society ought to work in an effective way, then in a way I can see that maybe we should just go ahead and build the consensus model of mind, whether or not we believe it's there, as accurately as possible, and just use that, because that might engage the public in a way that would lead to constructive change.
Well, actually, people have been doing it before already, haven't they? I mean, there have been these models of mind that seem to have influenced policy. So it seems to me that navigating and steering from pebble to pebble, rock to rock, and trying to find
Often policy changes. Policy often changes when individual findings that are particularly salient and interesting happen. Things like Beth Loftus's work on, false eyewitness testimony, or inducing false memories of childhood abuse, and things of this nature. These make a big impact, and sometimes society. When individual things happen of this sort that are known, or when neurological findings are found and so on, that are very salient and captivate the imagination of the public, they do lead to policy change. That happens. I think that's what happens more often than any global models. You know, it's the individual findings that capture the imagination and spirit that lead to change, I think. Maybe it shouldn't operate that way, but I think that's the way the real world works.
What do you think are the next primary directions from your viewpoint that this particular field will be?
Cognitive science?
I
imagine it's going to. The fact is, you can tell by looking at the way the society's proceedings have changed over the years, that the field keeps enlarging. New concepts and new approaches and new thoughts and things keep emerging all the time and becoming major fields. The mind is very complex, and everything that we as humans do is part of this enterprise. And we keep enlarging the scope of cognitive science, so it's not that I see cognitive science as going in any one direction. I think it just keeps branching and enlarging. And so sometimes we lose sight of the fact that these branches need to talk with each other. That's one of the big problems. And one of the goals of having a cognitive science meeting, if we're lucky, is to bring people from all these disparate branches back together and produce some synergy by bringing the different themes together. And if ideally things would work that way, in practice too often people tend to congregate with people who are doing the same things as themselves, and not enough synergy, even though you're at the same meeting. Maybe we don't often reach out enough to all the other themes that are going on and acquaint ourselves with them and learn from them. But still, that's the purpose of a cognitive science meeting, is to bring us together and learn from each other. But I don't see the field is moving in any one direction. I see it keep branching and covering more and more.
Yeah, there's just approaching 1,000 people down there. A lot of young faces as well. People looking for directions to go with their careers.
Any young person wants to be successful and get tenure and things of this nature. And one way to do that is to find what's currently hot, you know, the currently important threads that people are most excited by, and go into that. In addition, people would want probably to go into things that are funded, you know, where the government is currently funding. So neuroscience, for example, is a, you know, fMRI and so on is a big area of funding these days, and that attracts a lot of people because they know that they can get support for their research. But so as a young person, you know, you've got these influences that, you know, want to guide you, that you want to be successful, and we're all interested in, you know, solving scientific questions, carrying out research, and so on. But there's a lot of ways to go as a young person, and some of the themes that guide you are what's currently hot, what's exciting people, and what kinds of things are being supported currently. It's a short run sort of decision making, but it's as good as any.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. There's a couple of books I had in mind. One was the one by Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist, and there was the great one by Ramoni Cajal, Advice to a Young Investigator. You've partly done this, but if there's anything you want to add to what would be your advice to a young scientist, because I've spoken to a number of them, and in these times, several of them have said that they felt that they were in danger of becoming a lost generation of scientists.
Because of the financial constraints. There have always been subfields that have fallen out of favor, if you like, at least for a while, for various reasons. Maybe they're not trendy after a while, or they get a little old and tired, or maybe the funding mechanism, maybe people stop funding them and so on. And there's a tendency for people to downgrade them and cast them aside as no longer good science or something, which is unfortunate. So we've seen things like animal learning and so on fell out of favor for a while, but it sort of come back in a new guise. You know, as neuroscience started getting more and more important, then, you know, that's come back and is making a comeback in a new guise. This happens over and over again, I think, that that in a sense there's cycles of fads about what is currently hot research, and things ascend and then descend again. And if you're not in the ascendance as a scientist at any given moment, you worry a lot. Am I in a field that, you know, lost and nobody's going to care what I'm doing? And it's a valid worry. If you can take a long-run perspective, it's maybe not so bad, but people do tend to take a short-run perspective on these things. And, you know, the next few years you look at and so on. So it's a valid worry.
Well, you talk about interesting trends and so on. I mean, this is the cover of Time magazine, which is titled What Animals Think. New
Yes.
Science Reveals They're Smarter Than We Realized. And there's a little thought bubble here from this dog saying, way to go, Einstein. This is not because you said you were particularly not interested in working with rats, but what is your sense of animal cognition from a cog-sci perspective here? And are we too anthropocentric?
Well, of course, we're humans. I would say that comparative animal research is very important. Humans tend to be a bit, you know, focused on themselves. But fortunately, there's many people, not just because they have pets, but there's many people who are interested in the degree to which animals think. I mean, if you look, the nervous systems that many animals have are very similar to each other. The DNA that we have is shared throughout the animal kingdom to a very high degree. And it would be pretty silly for us to not learn something from animals and the way they operate. And much of what we think of as being guided by conscious decision processes and so on, when in fact they're guided by the same things that our dogs and cats and other animals are guided by. But we find excuses, let's say, to explain to ourselves why we're doing what we're doing consciously, when in fact probably the underlying mechanisms that are guiding us are very much the same as other animals.
Well, do you wrestle with these big questions? Do you, I mean, sort of memories, so, as you said, historically, anciently, implicitly, explicitly involved in all of these things. Do you wrestle with questions about free will and consciousness and qualia?
I think about them a lot. Sometimes they are not so easy to study empirically in the lab. And so I guess I would say that I worry about them in the sense like I think of them as puzzles. I don't worry about them. I think they're very interesting puzzles. And I think about them a lot in that sense. I think they're intellectually stimulating things to think about. And I do that. I tend to focus my research on things that I can take into the laboratory and study empirically and then, make models for. But I think, they're terrifically interesting questions, and many people find them so, and the lay public finds them so. Many of the things we don't study are the things that the non-scientists out there find the most interesting.
Well, yeah, meaning of life. And there's lots of new work going on. I was just talking to Alison Gopnik about this. A lot of people now beginning to get their arms around subjects like the evolution of and the science of morality.
Yes. It really is quite interesting that the move in cognitive science, part of cognitive science, toward higher and higher levels of mental cognition is a good one. So now we've had a big movement toward, at everywhere from the neurophysiological level up through cognitive science, we've seen all kinds of trends come in, like motivation, emotion, are becoming big factors that are not only important in their own right, but are important for things we ordinarily wouldn't have thought of, like memory and decision-making and so on. Morality is, of course, a big one. This is a big factor in human existence and society. And, it's a matter of finding tools to be able to study these things.
But again, is subject to the same sort of queries as this larger picture of the old divisions. Is this something that's innate, or is this something that we learn?
People like to make that division between learning and innateness, and sometimes it's a pretty fuzzy line between the two. We come designed by evolution. We are not a random collection of neural cells waiting to be programmed by backpropagation. Even though many of the models sort of do that as a stand-in for learning. We come with a brain that has modules that have been designed by evolution to do different things and operate together in very specific ways and so on. And it would be silly for us to ignore the fact that, we come equipped with machinery that's designed. So, a lot of stuff is innate,
Well, again, I talk to different people and the use of language and so on is not clear to me whether exactly what people are saying. So you could take a description where you had a massively modular mind, a kind of a Fodor-esque or a F-psych or a mind where there were a great many built-ins that were there actually in the genome.
Yeah, yeah.
Ready to be expressed during ontogeny.
Yep.
But I can easily go and find a whole bunch of people who would say that they don't subscribe to that at all, and they'd much rather say that really the major adaptation is the cortex, and it's an onboard computer, and we're shifting and changing things as we go along in real time online.
And I would say that's both true. The truth is they are both true. We are, we adapt and learn and use our neuromachinery to solve problems adaptively, and there's a lot of evidence about making use of our neuromachinery in ways that adapt to the environment and to our experience. As I say, one of my recent interests is in fact exploring how we learn from events and then adapt to them, build knowledge, and then encode events on the basis of our current knowledge. So this is a project that I want to explore much more now that from here on in, let's say. That's related in some way to this, indirectly to this issue. So I guess I would be on the side. Most of the modeling I do and most of the experimental research I do basically is treating the mind as sort of a general learner. Mm-hmm. You know, not some, I don't worry too much about the, I mean, I think about it, but I don't worry too much in my modeling about the fact that our brains are designed in modular ways by evolution in some ways that make it ready to do these things. So I just treat the mind as a general learning mechanism that does things in very general ways. But I do recognize that, we are designed by evolution in very specific ways.
Well, again, people choose sometimes to describe these things as constraints. Other people would describe them as enabling devices. So a lot of this gets into the...
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how this... I would really like to know, for example, in 100 years from now, how people are going to view this. Because we're going to have a much more complex and rich sense of what's really going on at levels all the way from the chemical up through the mind-body, you know, action environment. And at that point, it'll be interesting to see where the same issue or what the perspective will be on the same issue at that point. I'd be sort of curious, and I won't be around to know. But it would be nice to be able to look ahead and see what 100 years from now the perspective on this issue would be.
Yeah, I remember in one of the essays that each year John Brockman with his Edge organization has a question that he asks, sends out to the edgies and asks them to. One of the essays that Terry Sanofsky wrote in response to Brockman's question, he speculated in there that perhaps the extracellular matrix might be an answer to the perseveration of memories, because at least that's a reliably, you know, lasting structure.
I would like to know. I would say that sometimes I think that when people say the answer or an answer, you know, I sort of have to smile. I don't know if they themselves really think of things that way. It's the next answer, maybe that's what to describe it, or the current one, or the best current hypothesis, or the next idea that'll help explain things. Whatever we come up with now in terms of, quote, the answer about anything is vastly oversimplified. The brain is, as I say, the most incredibly complex, brain and mind are the most incredibly complex system we've ever decided to try to study. And there's no simple answer, but, you know, we get insights about what's going on, and we learn more and more and gradually converge on some kind of a more and more accurate description of the things that are going on and how it all operates.
So this, I assume this has been fun for you, this enterprise. Is there anything else that you would have, is there anything else you'd have considered doing? Are you a frustrated bass player or something?
I guess I, in my life away from, let's say research and psychology, I like sports, and I've moved around from sport to sport over my life as my physical infirmities have guided me away from some sports that prevent me from doing them, like bad knees and a bad back. So I've moved from things that I couldn't do, like impact sports, into things I can do now, like backcountry skiing and rock climbing. But
that's the easy stuff.
That's the easy stuff. The funny thing is, people don't realize that. But if you can't have impact, rock climbing, you're on a rope and you don't land on anything. You know, especially when you're hanging from a cliff or something, you're hanging on a rope. It's, you know, if you fall, it's like a bungee cord. It's no impact. And if you're backcountry skiing in powder, you know, it's soft, fluffy stuff. You know, it's not no impact. So these are things that, you know, you can do if you have bad joints and bad backs and things like that. So I've moved into that. So I do a lot of that. And, you know, run conference that allows this sort of activity and things of this nature. And I do that when I can't think anymore. So, you know, I reach a point in the day, I go into work early in the morning, work for N hours, reach a point where, you know, I can't really do constructive and really good intellectual work. And then I go to the gym, say, the climbing gym, and set some roots or something. It's a different kind of activity, and it's also fun. And I like to, you know.
So one question I ask everybody is get some sense of the history of science as well. This actually happens to be the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society. So Hooke and Boyle and all those people. If I gave you a time travel token and said to you, you can bring anybody to your dinner table, who do you want to talk to? What would you like to ask?
Yeah, well, part of the answer, of course, I'd have to know what their personality was like. It would be nice to have someone that would actually talk, you know, and be able to converse with, and that's probably an important factor. Who knows? I don't know enough about many of these historical figures to know what their personality was actually like, whatever their reputation is. And it's not clear that I would want to talk to a scientist. I might be equally interested to talk with Mozart or, you know, something like that.
That would be interesting,
yeah. So I guess if I really had a choice and had a language in common, I'd probably want to go back. I'm most interested in the fact that humanity was incredibly smart from the earliest recorded days. I guess I'd like to talk to somebody like Aristotle. You know, I mean, there's a sense in which I don't know if humanity has progressed that much from the earliest recorded days of history. technologically, yes, but in terms of the way we think about things, it's not clear. So I'd like to know, you know, did they have any different insights, any different way of thinking about things, you know, than we do now? Maybe they were facing all the same problems and thinking all the same things at that time. We know a little bit about it from the writings, but, you know, most of that's been lost. And it would be nice to just have a conversation with someone from the earliest days. You know, I wouldn't know who to ask from even earlier days because, you know, at some point we don't know who they are.
So you're giving Aristotle a copy of the New York,
a long way,
copy of the New York Times and say, so what do you make of this then?
Yeah, I'd like to talk with them about the way they think about things and see, you know, because really from a evolutionary perspective, you know, even if we go back 5,000 years or something, that's almost nothing, you know, in the advancement of humanity. It's a lot in terms of technology, but it's only a little in terms of the way we think and do things. So I'd sort of like to go back a long way and talk to someone from, you know, sort of the earliest days of our history, even though it's only a tiny segment of humanity, in going back that far. I think that I'd find most interesting, probably.
What are you optimistic about?
Well, that's, you know, I'm not sure how optimistic I am, to tell you the truth. You know, there's, humans seem to repeat themselves in terms of the errors they make society in, you know, sort of a societal fashion, over and over and over again. So with all the advances we've made over the years in terms of understanding what we should be doing, we keep regressing, we keep fighting wars, we keep doing things to destroy the environment because we have a very short-term perspective on things. And at the same time that we know as scientists, for example, or as non-scientists, what things we should be doing, we still don't do the right things. And it's not at all clear to me where the future is going to go. I mean, whether we're going to solve these problems and become a more rational society that makes good decisions, or whether we're going to go down the wrong road and effectively destroy ourselves. I don't know where things are going to go. Am I optimistic? I guess I'm uncertain. I just don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that we will advance as a race and as society and make things work. And if technology would come through with some really important magic solutions, like, you know, fusion or something that would solve many of the current problems we see, that might provide a temporary fix, but you know, humans, you know, the basic aspects of humanity that drive us to make bad decisions don't seem to go away. And I don't know where things are going to go. I'd like to see education improve worldwide so that we could get better decisions.
Some of the things that you were saying in the notion about whether or not you're optimistic or just plain realistic.
Maybe a better way to describe it.
There was a brief, it was called an update in a recent issue of Trends in Cognitive Sciences by Mike Gzaniger. And the title, the official title, was Neuroscience and the Correct Level of Explanation for Understanding Mind. And the subtitle was An Extraterrestrial Roams Through Some Neuroscience Laboratories and concludes, Earthlings are not grasping how best to understand the mind-brain interface. And basically he just elaborates on that and talks about whether you can get from folk Sebastian Sung's work about whether you can get from folk psychology to atomic psychology, where you actually can make predictions, know the initial conditions of every atom in somebody's brain and move on to a perfect, you know, it's preposterous in one sense, but I mean that is certainly what I think people out there might think that science is ultimately hoping to do.
One of the more interesting questions that actually we face in cognitive science is connecting levels of explanation from, let's say, chemistry and physics, which are of course what we're all built out of, to successively higher levels, neuronal interactions and synaptic interfaces and phasic brainwaves and so on, up to cognition, as we think of it, and consciousness, and decision-making, and emotions, and so on. Connecting all these different levels to each other when they're really quite different levels of explanation is one of the big puzzles of how, you know, little pieces of that we understand. We can connect adjacent levels. We use neural net models, sort of, to connect physiology to behavior in a sort of, a semi-descriptive way. It's not real physiology and maybe not real behavior, but it's right at the interface, and it sort of shows how we can get from one level to another, but it's only like adjacent levels that are close enough to talk to each other. And if we try to expand that to the point where we're talking about, you know, very high level cognitive concepts on the one hand and chemistry on the other hand, how to connect these levels of explanation to each other is a very, very difficult and interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. We can sort of see how we can connect things up as we move through adjacent levels of description where they're close to each other. But when we get far enough apart, we sort of lose the connection somewhere along the way, and it's not clear anymore that we're really talking to each other.
Hmm. So do you have kids?
Yep. I have four children.
Would you have, I mean, are there any of them going to be scientists? Would you do a very good job of selling science as a good career for them to go into?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've got none of my kids are in science. They're old enough that they know what they're doing, more or less. I didn't try to get them to go into science. I let them go into what they wanted. So one's currently in Washington working in the government. That's my son. He's the second oldest. He's working on environmental and governmental regulatory for the Governmental Accountability Office, GAO. I've got a daughter who does law, but social service law. You know, the kind that doesn't make any money, in Madison, Wisconsin, helping people. And she's a lawyer. And the younger ones, I've got one that has done various things, including educational stuff like teaching SATs and business GMATs and law boards and things like that. But has since decided she really wants to go into writing and is going back to school so she can go into writing, which she really loves. And the youngest is going to nursing. So they're all over the map, and none in science.
Well, no, I would disagree with you. I would say that those are all four descriptions of people who would probably welcome empirical evidence.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah. I think they are, they understand. These are the kind of people I feel that, you know, I could talk to about all these things we've been talking about and would understand and be able to process it properly.
And for the one who's going to be a writer, this is a volume by Billy Collins, who is the poet laureate of the United States, 2002-2003. Uh-huh. He has a poem called Forgetfulness. Let me just read you a couple of paragraphs.
Okay. I'd be interested. Yeah. I don't know that, but I'd be interested.
The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you've never read, never even heard of, as if one by one the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag, and even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away, a state flower perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay, and he goes on for some. This is another way of describing memory, of course. And
you know, one of the big debates in memory is about the permanence of memory and whether things that are lost are really lost or are just due to context, let's say, changes are becoming accessible, and whether they're retrievable if we only had the right context to reconstruct things properly and so on. And it's a difficult question to answer. We still don't know, you know, to the degree to which we do know that memories change. We can add and change information in memories, so we know that's true. But the degree to which what appears to be lost memories are actually there somewhere in some form that can be accessed if we could only reconstruct the context properly is still an open question. We don't really know the answer. And that's one of the interesting questions about context.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, this is why I read this, because of the context thing. And you go and read Borges and look at Funes Memorias and so on. There's lots of wonderful things in literature.
See, we do know that some memories that we think we've lost can be recovered, but that's not a proof that the others aren't lost. You know, so we, the fact that we can go back and get some that appear to be lost, and then we can reconstruct them and reconstruct the context and go back and get them, sometimes.
But I also think about the work of Liz Phelps or Joe Ledoux or lots of papers out there now about extinguishing fear memories, say.
Well, that's another interesting issue. There's a difference. There's inhibition processes all over the brain, and we can, and we know we can change memories. We can add information. We can, but the question is, do we really lose information or just add information? You know, it's a subtle question sometimes, and it's many questions that I was saying we don't know much about memory. There's still many open questions that we'd like to know the answers to. We really don't know yet about how these things work.
But you end up seeing papers, seeing commentaries in science journals now with titles like Eternal Sunshine of a Murine Mind, because of looking at mouse memories and so on and so forth. Reference being obviously Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. So it's an area that just has a huge resonance with the general public,
yeah.
Obviously for the obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons, yeah.
We all deal in these things.
Yeah, I love to, you know, the main focus of my research has always been on memory, and it still is. And I find it extremely fascinating. And it's a terrific intellectual puzzle. I enjoy it. I enjoy what I do. And I don't pretend I know more than I really do, but I find it just really fascinating and interesting to work in these areas.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing what your current research program, the one on context, produces. When can we talk again on that one?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I wouldn't... The current research program is, I wouldn't describe as directly focusing on context. It's a construct we use all the time. Everyone uses all the time. And a little of my research has been directed at context directly. But the main focus, as I say these days, is using context in the background as a construct, as part of our models. But the focus is on actually the co-evolution of knowledge growing from events and of events being coded by knowledge and how those work together to form memories and to allow us to retrieve memories and so forth. Context is there in the background, But I haven't been doing that much current research on directly exploring context in the laboratory. I may get back to that, but I've done a little on that. But it's more of a theoretical construct. We know is there is important, but I'm looking at other aspects of memory because the context and truth is hard to study. It's those things that, it's almost defined by the fact that they're the things that we don't find easy to study in the laboratory. It's everything else that we don't study is almost the definition of context. So that sort of makes it hard to take into the laboratory.
Well, we can talk about it again, Richard Schifrin. It's been great fun talking to you. Perhaps when we next meet, we should meet here so we'll have a better context in which to remember what we said today. So,
well, I'd be happy to visit you in sunny California.